around them. If he is adept at his task, members of the flock will readily lay down their lives in defense against this phantom threat. Ask them why, and they will state that their fatalistic beliefs are merely the result of unbiased, objective observation of the world around them. They are telling the truth. They just do not grasp the fact that they do not believe based on what they observe. They observe based on what they have been tricked into believing. And so it goes for all of us. Chapter 8. Attack of the Fuck Roaches. Me. John took a bite of a walnut and chocolate chip pancake and said, "Assuming the little girl wasn't just confused, what does Nymph gain by imitating you when he goes to kidnap her?" I said, "Trying to find logic in anything they do is like asking what motivates glass to cut your mouth when you try to eat it." We were at Waffle House, which I felt was a big step down from Denny's, which had been our comfort food refuge for years going back to high school. Our Denny's had never reopened after it burned to the ground a few years ago during an event we refer to only as the incident. Losing Denny's was one of those things that I wouldn't have thought would create a hole in my life, but it did, though still not as much as when all the stores in the area stopped carrying Mountain Dew Code Red last year. We'd worried that the Waffle House had gotten flooded out already, but not only was it open, but the waitress claimed the chain is so famous for staying open during disasters that FEMA has a Waffle House Index. They can actually judge the scale of a natural disaster by how many Waffle House locations have closed in the area. Amy was nursing a cup of hot tea and had made the comment that she was never going to eat waffles again. I said, "Would you have preferred Taco Bell? I think they're still open." "Can't stand the smoke. And the only thing I'd like there is those frozen things, the Choco Taco." John said, "I wonder if there's a porno by that name." Amy said, "And I disagree about there being no logic. We need to find out exactly how and why it does what it does. Everything operates by rules. Everything has limits. Everything has a weakness. You just have to understand them." I noticed that the three of us had in turn referred to Nymph as he, they, and it. I said, "Just to reduce confusion, let's all agree to refer to Nymph as a person, even though we all know he was not actually a person and was some kind of, swarm of bugs that serve something else. The master. For now, we're going to refer to him as a man, just for simplicity's sake." John said, "Well, he's not even the problem at the moment, right? The more immediate issue is if Ted goes looking for more evidence and every sign points to you having kidnapped his child." I shushed John and gave a nervous look around. "Dude, we are in public right now." "We're in Waffle House. Half the people here are probably murderers. So if he can imitate anybody, why not turn himself into her mom or dad? Wouldn't that make the abduction easier? Going as you is no different from going as himself. You're a stranger to her. Plus, look at you. No little girl is going to follow you anywhere. It's a horrible disguise." "So maybe he did it to frame me? Just to be a dick? Look around. Cruelty doesn't need a reason." I looked at Amy. "It's like those whales." Once, Amy and I watched a BBC documentary series about sea life called The Blue Planet, because sometimes you just run out of stuff to watch. There was one scene where the crew tracked a gray whale and its newborn calf up the Pacific Ocean. These whales carry their babies for 13 months. Then, after giving birth, they have to laboriously migrate thousands of miles north to find food. So they're slowly swimming up the California coast to Alaska, mother and baby side by side the whole way, like characters in a Pixar movie. But then, a pod of 15 killer whales comes along, a pack of hunters, silently coordinating as they stealthily surround the doting mother and her baby. They swam in and started pushing themselves in between the mother and the child, separating them, and then jumping on top of the calf to try to drown it. Remember, whales are mammals that breathe air. They're not just spitting up at the surface for fun. The mother frantically tried to push the baby back up so it could get a breath, But the killer whales just kept at it for 6 hours, pushing the sputtering calf down and down again, while its mother watched, relentless. Finally, they started biting at the infant, the churning water around them blooming bright red. Then came the twist ending. As soon as the baby was dead, the killer whales just swam away. They took a couple of bites out of it and just let its dead, broken body sink to the bottom. It turned out they weren't hungry. They had just killed a child in front of its mother, purely for fun. The final shot was of this mother whale, drifting aimlessly in the middle of the ocean, utterly alone. The killer whales swam off to live the rest of their lives healthy and happy and completely free of any consequence. There would be no justice for what happened, or even revenge. No one would console the mother. She was now completely devoid of purpose in an endless, cold, uncaring ocean. Amy had nightmares about it for 6 weeks after. She sipped her tea and said, "Fine, but let's assume for the moment there's more to it. What's his goal?" I shrugged. "Maybe just what he said, to feed or breed, or both." John said, "And he kept taking the master's food to the pond, which happens to be at the mouth of the old mine. So, being a highly trained expert in this subject, I'm going to go way out on a limb and say that the thing he's trying to feed is in that mine." I asked Amy, "And you're sure you didn't see anything while you were there?" "Well, there was this gigantic serpent with 1,000,000 eyes and 1,000 butts, but I didn't think it was important, so I didn't mention it." "That'll be enough sarcasm, young lady. That's not helpful." John said, "How did you get away again?" "I had my stun gun, the one you gave me. I waited until David, or the thing that was pretending to be David, wasn't paying attention, and then I zapped him, right in the crotch, over and over again. Then I grabbed the girl and we ran up the hill. It didn't follow, like I said." "Why is she lying?" John said, "Is there any chance it let you get away? On purpose?" "You guys seem to find it impossible to comprehend that I could have managed an escape without your help." I said, "Come on, you know what we're saying here. I can't shake the feeling that everything we've done has been in service to what he wants, that this is all part of his plan." "Either way," said John, "you know at some point we're going to have to go back to that mine." "Unless," I said, "that's what it wants, and we'd just be opening Pandora's box." John said, "Now, I'm sure there's a porno called that." "Okay, so how long till Ted goes to the cops with his story?" "If we're lucky, he waits and gathers more information first. If we're unlucky, he's talking to them right now. If we're really unlucky, he doesn't go to them at all." "Why would that be oh, right. It means he intends to come gunning for me in a rampage of cold-blooded vengeance. So, we've got to figure all this out before that happens." "Okay, I'll get this next cup of coffee to go." John wanted to stop by his house to let his dog out, and neither Amy nor I pointed out that the unspoken second half of that sentence was, "and also do some of the drugs that let me stay awake for 50 hours at a time." Amy and I waited in the Jeep. Once we were alone, I said, "When you were talking to my doppelganger, or whatever, how long did it take you to figure out it wasn't me? I mean, you had breakfast with it, right?" For the second time, Amy looked briefly like she'd been caught. She tried to play it off and said, "Not long. We ate and made small talk for a bit, but I was uneasy the whole time. You had a third arm, but I figured maybe I'd just never noticed it before." "I'm serious, Amy. You and I know each other better than we know anyone else in the world. It's creepy to think you could talk to a fake me through a whole meal before figuring out what was happening." "You were acting weird. But how weird would somebody have to act before you started thinking supernatural imposter instead of, oh, they're being a little weird today? You just seemed like..." She stared at the rain for a moment. "Like what?" "Like you were in a really good mood."
"Okay."
"You said you had fixed the leak in the roof."
"Well, that should have tipped you off right there."
I expected her to laugh at this, but she didn't. John reappeared at his door and, looking frantic, yelled that we had to come in and see something. As always, I felt that emotion for which there is no word in English, a momentary anticipation of something either incredibly dangerous or incredibly stupid. Whether he had found in his home a dozen mutilated corpses or a tomato that was sort of shaped like a dick, John would announce it in the exact same way. We entered to find Dioji in the corner playing with something, snapping at it and batting it around with his paws. I thought at first it was a little wounded sparrow or hummingbird, but it was, in fact, one of the insect-like flying creatures that had previously been part of Nymph's human body. It was wounded. Amy said, "Don't let him eat it." I said, "Yeah, it'd probably make him sick. Who knows what that thing's guts are made of? Don't touch it with your hands either. Find something sharp you can use to stab it from afar. John, which spears do you still have?" Amy said, "Wait." She ran into the kitchen and came back with a clear plastic pitcher. "Grab the dog." John was able to pull the thrashing dog away from its prize, and Amy coaxed the little insect creature into the pitcher. She replaced the lid, and John ran duct tape around the lip. Amy said, "I need a knife or something so we can cut air holes for it." I said, "Who even says it breathes air?" John said, "More important, who's to say it can't squeeze out of a hole, even a tiny one, or that it can't spit venom or something? No, until we figure out what we're dealing with, let's err on the side of keeping it sealed." John sat the pitcher on his coffee table, and we all gathered around. It was hard to get a look at the creature, in the way that it's hard to get a look at the little bits of lint floating around in front of your eyes. It could almost perfectly blend with the background when it wanted to. Occasionally, it would drop its cover, and for just a few seconds, we'd glimpse its true body. It appeared to be a pink, greasy, segmented thing about the size of a child's hand, its body polka-dotted with shiny black spots, or eyes, from one end to the other. The spots were hexagonal, and as we watched, they would expand until they covered the creature's body. Then, they would change color and project its camouflage, somehow. Along the bottom were two rows of thin little legs that ended in flexing hooked feet. It had a pair of translucent wings like a housefly, one of which had been damaged. Amy said, "I assume we've never run into one of these before?" John said, "It's my turn to name it." I said, "No, John, not unless you give it a name that actually makes sense." John is very big on having us name every species and phenomena we come across, insisting that we should take a scientific approach and create a Charles Darwin-esque catalog of our discoveries. We have to rotate this task because, despite claiming that it's all for science, John also insists on coming up with just horrendously unhelpful names. He was the one who classified a supernatural abduction as a screaming clown dick, for instance. An insect-like parasite we observed inhabiting a person's mouth and speaking in their voice was dubbed the Flip Whipple Blip. And the inky black entities with the incomprehensible power to shape reality, according to their whims, are now known as night sharts. You might have noticed that his names are too busy being whimsical or profane to actually be descriptive at all, rendering them impossible to remember and thus utterly defeating the purpose. John thought carefully, then said, "It's limp and pink like a dick, and has wings like an insect. I hereby christen this organism the fuckroach." Amy sighed. The fuckroach buzzed clumsily around inside the pitcher, its gimpy wing having been damaged during our encounter and or while being chewed on by Dioji. Convinced it couldn't escape its prison, it settled to the bottom and folded its wings over its body. I said, "Well, Dr. Marconi definitely needs to see this." John said, "I'll try his number." Then he pulled out his knife and started cutting open the pitcher. He was doing it because he needed his phone, and his phone was currently sitting at the bottom of said pitcher, which was otherwise empty. Amy and I actually watched John slice around the tape and start prying off the lid. Then Amy shook her head like she was waking up from a trance and quickly reached out to snatch John's wrist. "Wait, what are we doing?" John stopped, and all of us stared for a moment. I blinked, and the cell phone became that bug thing again, the image of the phone vanishing into its cluster of black, shimmering eyes. It tried to fly again, bouncing off the lid. John said, "Okay, that was weird." I said, "It didn't just make itself look like a phone. It convinced me it was a phone, like against all other evidence to the contrary." John said, "It's like it can reach in and just turn off all the logic circuits in your brain. All of your critical thought goes out the window like in a dream. Suddenly, you're back in high school, and a parrot with the voice of your gym coach is pulling all of your teeth out with its beak, but the whole time your only thought is, 'How am I going to explain this to the dentist?'" Amy said, "It happened when it put its wings down. I think its body can make it look like something else. But when it layers the wings, it becomes hypnotic or something. I think we need to cover it up so we can't see it." John grabbed the American flag blanket from the back of a nearby armchair and tossed it over the coffee table. I said, "Well, do you even think it works by sight?" Amy shrugged. "If not, I wouldn't even know where to start as far as precautions go." Still, John put it in the closet just to add one more layer of protection in the form of a flimsy wooden door. Amy said, "All right, let's shift back into Sherlock mode. The thing wanted out of the picture, and so turned itself into something that would make us want to free it. See? Even an alien bug thing operates on logic. So what can we deduce from the other forms it's taken?" John said, "Well, we know it plays on fear. Ted is a father, and he saw a pedophile. I saw a Wall Street type because, as you know, I am concerned about issues of economic justice and class exploitation. Dave, what did you see? A clown? Your landlord? Fred Durst? Vegetarian meatloaf? Your own sexual inadequacy?" "I saw myself. A cooler, healthier version." John said, "Well, we'd be here all night unpacking that." Amy said, "It couldn't fool the dog. It was trying to eat it, so its camouflage couldn't trick him. That's good, right? We've got a fudge roach detector. He tries to bite somebody we know to be suspicious." "Assuming," I said, "that there's more of these things." "There are. John was dealing with Nymph at the same time I was dealing with the fake you, so yes, there's at least one more person's worth of these things out there." John said, "There could be at least two more if they're both midgets." I could feel a headache coming on. I pressed my fingers to my temples and said, "Or 1,000, I mean, how deep does this go?" Amy sat back on the sofa and ran her hand through her hair. "Well, what matters is we got the little girl back. As far as I'm concerned, that means we won today." Chapter 9. Another Child Goes Missing. It was mid-afternoon when Amy and I got back home. The overflowing drainage ditches had brought burbling water just 20 feet from the foundation of the dildo store. For a moment, I was thankful we were on the second floor, but if the first floor flooded, we couldn't just keep living up there and mocking the peasants drowning in the streets below us. I assumed the power would go out as wiring got submerged, plus the roads would be impassable. So if the rain didn't stop and the flood water kept coming, where would we go? I guess the first option would be to stay at John's place, but his neighborhood didn't seem to be on much higher ground than mine, and about 2 days under the same roof would surely mean the end of our friendship. Amy got out of her wet clothes and collapsed on the bed as soon as we got inside. She had to be back at work at 11, you know, to keep food on my table. I lay there with her for a while, my arm around her shoulders, her facing away from me. "Are you okay?" She muttered, "As okay as is reasonable to expect a person to be after this particular day." She lay in silence for a bit while I tried to think of how to phrase this next question. I said, "The thing that was pretending to be me, my doppelganger, it didn't, hurt you, did it? It didn't try to assault you?" No, no. Okay. Silence. But I know you're not telling me something. I swear to God, David, that I've told you every piece of useful information I can remember. And if I remember more, I'll tell you that, too. But no, I don't feel like reliving every single moment of what happened today. That shouldn't be this hard to understand. It's just, you don't keep things from me, ever. That's not you. I keep things from you that you don't want to know. That's, no, like what? David, I need to sleep. When we fight, I cry, and I get this adrenaline rush, and then instead of sleeping, I lay here for 6 straight hours thinking about what we yelled at each other. Just let me sleep. I don't want to fight, but like, what do you keep from me? Just give me an example. What do you feel like you can't tell me? You told me how the painkillers make you constipated. If you were comfortable sharing that, I can't tell you things that are going to send you spiraling into a depression. I mean, just what I'm saying now, I feel like that's enough to do it. I'm sorry if I give that impression, but come on. If I told you, Amy, there are really important things that I withhold from you, you'd drive yourself crazy trying to find out what it was. There's nothing I could say that would be worse than what you'd guess. Give me an example, that's all. She sighed, rubbed her eyes, and said, "We didn't have enough to make rent in February. I had to borrow it from John." I felt a black ooze of shame bubble up from a drain in my skull. Hey, she was right. I tried to formulate the perfect response, one that would reassure her, one that would convince her that she was being silly, that I wasn't so fragile. 20 minutes later, I was still trying to formulate that response, and by then Amy was snoring softly, like she does. I quietly got up and closed the bedroom door. I went to the bathroom, stood over the sink, just staring at myself in the mirror. Then it hit me. There is no drip. It was still pouring outside, but the ceiling was dry. Wait, did the David doppelganger actually fix the roof? I shuffled back through the kitchen. The breakfast plates in the sink, the syrup. I tried to picture Amy eating breakfast with a functioning copy of me, having a casual conversation with it. The junk had been cleared from the card table, the last round of crap I'd been mailed, the Rodman book and the Demon Marvel, all of it was gone, and I didn't see it on the floor. I went to the junk room, and, sure enough, the stuff had been stashed away, presumably by my doppelganger. It was now arranged neatly on a shelf right next to the one-armed concrete snowman we always kept in there. My phone rang. It was John. I answered, "Fuck you and all the child slaves who manufactured your phone." "Shit just got real. Turns out there are more." "More what?" "Maggie wasn't the only kid to go missing last night. There was at least one more." "Oh, fuck." "Kid belongs to a single mom. Report didn't get taken seriously by police dispatch because she sounded out of her mind. Hers got taken around the same time, they think." "What the hell, John?" "I got in touch with her. Name is Chastity Payton. She's willing to talk to us." "Of course she is. She lives at Camelot Terrace." "All right, you want to come pick me up?" "I'm downstairs, in the parking lot." "Of course you are. Give me a minute." "One more thing." "It can't wait 30 seconds until I come downstairs?" "No. I was getting ready to leave, and I go to grab my keys, but I couldn't remember where I left them. Then I said to myself, oh, I know where they are. You want to guess where I thought they were?" I've totally lost track of the story. "I was convinced my keys were in the closet, in the pitcher. I could vaguely remember sealing them in there for no reason whatsoever. It was the fuck roach trying to get me to come let it out." "Holy shit, that's weird. You can't keep that thing at the house. It's going to mess with your brain." "What else can I do with it?" "Yeah, one of these days we should establish some kind of procedure for that, for all of this. Anyway, I buried it in the backyard. We'll see if that helps." I hung up and headed down. John urgently met me at the bottom stair, grabbing my arm and hustling me around the front of the building and through the entrance of the dildo store. "What the—" "Ted Knoll just pulled in." I turned and saw the red Impala slide into a parking space. I assumed he wasn't here for a pair of edible panties. We pushed our way toward the back of the store and hid behind a shelf. Behind us was a huge wall of life-size silicone butts.
Jesus Christ, John, he couldn't wait one day to go on a vigilante rampage? He should be home with his daughter.
How long would you wait? I glanced back at the butts.
What are those for?
Dave, I can't emphasize enough how growing up in this town has stunted your worldview. Ted stepped out of the car, striding through the rain and looking for an entrance to the upstairs apartment. No sign he'd seen us. John said,
What are we going to do if he goes upstairs? Amy's up there.
Yeah, we need a plan. How about we just go out there and tell him the truth? I said,
We don't even know what the truth is. There's another missing kid, so for all we know, he has already come across somebody's cell phone video of me mutilating a small...
A sales clerk walked by, and John loudly said,
Yes, David, I agree. We should cover our floor in rubber asses.
The front door dinged, and in walked Ted. The store was tiny, and hiding from him was a ridiculous notion. He made eye contact and strode up to us, saying, Why don't y'all step outside with me? I said,
I'm fine right here.
Suit yourself. And you need to think hard about what you're about to do, about whether you really want to do it. You a mind reader now? See, I've been busy. Spent all afternoon catching up, reading about you, about this town.
Ted, you want my advice? Move. There can't be anything tying you down here.
You telling me how to live my life now?
Think.
What's happening, Ted, is exactly what we told you to expect when all this started. Mind games. That's all it is. They're framing me for the crime because that's the sort of shit they do for fun. Uh-huh. You know, I started looking close at my alarm system. I couldn't get past the fact that nothing tripped it, that the cameras went dark at just the right time. I even called Littleton, the company I bought it from. They say everything looked just fine and dandy on their end. But then I talked to that detective, the one that was there this morning, and he tells me offhand that your girl works in the Littleton call center. Really interesting how you never brought that up.
Thanks, detective.
I said, You've got to be shitting me. You think, what, I had Amy shut off your alarm? She couldn't even do that if she wanted to, as far as I know. She didn't even know about Maggie until I told her. But I'm not going to convince you, am I? You're not here to find the truth. You're here to get revenge.
I'm here because I wanted to look you in the eye.
See, in a movie, the tough guy goes on the warpath. He's always got one thing you never get in real life. Certainty. Batman stands on a roof and he sees a mugging happen down on the street, always right in front of him. Real convenient. Doesn't have to wrestle with doubt or finding out he did harm to an innocent person by mistake.
No, I'm not doing nothing until I know for sure. But I will know for sure, one way or another. And soon.
Then what? You kill me, you go to jail, and your little girl doesn't have a father in her life? I pushed past him and went out the front door. He followed.
I'm telling you, Ted, walk away. Pack up and go, and I mean tonight, for your sake, and your little girl's. Loretta, too.
Ted grabbed my shoulder and spun me around. He stared at me and said,
Is that a threat?
John. Lightning flashed across the sky, and John saw the rage illuminated on both men's faces. In that moment, John was sure that one of the two, Dave or Ted, wasn't going home alive. John said,
Ted, you need to just calm down.
You keep your enormous cock out of this, John. This is between me and him.
Dave shrugged out of Ted's grip. His eyes narrowed in the way that they did when Dave was feeling that rage fire inside him. It was like he was trying to keep the blaze from flying out of his eye sockets and obliterating everything, Cyclops style. Dave gritted his teeth and said,
You've had a trauma, Mr. Knoll. You're not thinking clearly. Trust me, an additional trauma won't make it better. I don't want to fight you, but if you want to fight, I'll give you one.
Dave pulled his shirt over his head, exposing the torso of a badly shaved bear.
Look, you see this scar on my chest? That's a bullet wound. You see this scar on my shoulder? That's a knife wound. I did that one myself. See the one on my cheek? I can't even explain that one in a way that you'd believe. I got a half dozen more I can't show you unless we go somewhere private. I've been cut, I've been burned, I've been chewed on, I've been tasered. So yeah, you want a fight? I'll give you a fight. I won't win. You're a trained soldier, and I'm a sack of guts designed to convert beer into piss and depression. But I'll say this, nobody who's ever fought me has ever come back for seconds. Lightning flashed. Ted sneered and said, "Oh yeah? Well, maybe you don't survive this one." John said, "Mr. Knoll, think about what you're accusing him of and all you've seen today. You're not accusing him of stealing your child. You're accusing him of stealing your child using dark magic. You want to fight a kitty diddler in a dildo store parking lot? I understand that completely. I've done that myself. But are you sure you want to fight a sexual deviant who is also a wizard? That's how you wind up with a cursed asshole." Dave said, "Look, we just talked to the cops. Your Maggie wasn't the only kid to go missing last night. There was at least one more, and John and I are the best chance at finding them, and whoever's doing this. You want to think we're behind it? Behind all of this? That's fine. You keep thinking it. Follow us around town if you want. But what's happening here, it's bigger than us. And if you think you're going to stand in our way, then I've got just one thing to say to you. Me. I'm very sorry for everything you've been through, and all I can do is beg for your patience. Give us 24 hours to solve this. After that, if you want to kill me, go right ahead. Not like the flags are going to fly at half-mast the next day." Ted worked his jaw, grunted, then turned and headed back toward his Impala, shaking his head. He stabbed his finger back toward me and said, "I'll be watching. You can guarantee it." As he pulled away, John stepped back under the awning of the Venus flytrap to get out of the rain. He lit a cigarette and asked, "If it comes down to you and that guy, like if he forces the issue, what will you do? I know you don't want to kill anybody, but..." "I don't know, man. You've killed him once already. How was it?" "Let me ask you something else. When you walked in and saw what looked like me on the couch having committed suicide, did you believe it?" "Well, yeah, it looked completely real. But in that moment, did you believe I had done it? That it was something I would do? Do you think I'm suicidal?" "Well, no. I don't know. Why didn't you assume that I was murdered and it was just staged as a suicide?" "I don't know. I only had a few minutes to think about it. I don't understand what you're asking." "If Nymph creates these doppelgangers out of your own mind, if he picks through and pulls out the things you're most afraid of, why did you have that on the brain?" "I don't know. I didn't." "Because you know I would never do that, right? I would never leave the job unfinished. I would never leave you guys behind. It wouldn't even cross my mind. It wouldn't cross Amy's either." "Great, John. Good to hear. Let's go." "Aren't we waiting for Amy?" "She's asleep. She has to work." "Did you ask her if she wanted to go?" "No, she was asleep when you called." "Go wake her up and ask her." "I am not going to do that because she's going to be pissed off that I woke her up to go do this bullshit when she has to work a night shift. You want to do it, go right up there. But let her know it was your idea when she tells you to fuck off." 20 minutes later, John, Amy, and I pulled into Camelot Terrace. Not the best trailer park in town, but not the shittiest either. Maybe the fourth shittiest. "The detective said she was nuts," said John. "But who knows what that even means in this town. I asked her how to find the trailer, and she said look for the one with the sandbags." Amy said, "She's a single mom?" "Yeah, I don't know if there's a dad in the picture somewhere." "That's interesting. The Knowles were separated. Could be a pattern." John said, "I don't think that's a pattern in these crimes so much as it's just a pattern in America in general. Also got a similar sounding name to the other kid. Mikey." Amy said, "Up there." Chastity's trailer was, in fact, the only one in the park with a waist-high wall of white sandbags around it. We climbed over the barrier,
and knocked. The door was opened by a black woman who was built like an NFL defensive lineman. As a greeting, she said, "Oh, shit!" John said, "Miss Peyton, my name is..."
"I know who you are. I got the internet. Isn't there supposed to be a third one? Little red-headed girl with glasses?"
"Oh, there she is. Didn't see her standing off to the side." I said, "Yeah, did John explain why we're here?"
"Come in. You look like a bunch of pissed-on toilet rats out there."
The furniture and floor of Chastity's living room were covered in clear plastic drop cloths, like she was expecting a bloodbath. There was a huge stuffed fish mounted on the wall. I said, "If you don't mind me asking, how did you get sandbags?" She shrugged.
"I paid a couple of guys to put down sandbags. Did it 2 weeks ago. Only took them one day. Couple of rednecks, worked like horses. Neighbors thought I was crazy. Now, who's crazy? Got a gas generator, too. Enough to keep the fridge and lights on if the grid goes down. Got big head carp in the deep freeze caught with these two hands. Well, I used a poll, you know. If you can't do the basics for yourself, you're a slave to the system. You want something to drink? Got milk, juice, and water. That's it. No booze, no coffee, no soft drinks. Can't afford addictions in my life. You gonna ask me about Mikey?"
I said, yeah. "Before he went missing, did a creepy guy come around? A stranger, I mean?"
"Not that I saw."
"Is he a ghost?"
John said, "Why do you ask that?"
"Whoever took Mikey, he was a ghost or a ninja, and I think I would have still heard a ninja. I was sleeping right there on that sofa at the time. Guy would have had to go right past me. Twice. And I'm a light sleeper. And even if this freak's a master of stealth, even if he can float across the floor like a hummingbird, you'd think Mikey would have made a fuss all the way out the door. This is a boy who kicked a hole in the paneling by the bed because he was having a bad dream. You found that little blonde girl out by the spooky old mine, right? You check around there real good, make sure no other kids were stashed nearby?"
We actually hadn't done that, but John said, "Yeah, the cops are swarming that whole area, but they haven't turned up anything. Not a lot of places to hide somebody. There's those few cabins and stuff, but nobody lives around there. Nobody wants to. People think the devil lives down in that mine. Of course, that's just people telling stories. I always tell them, you want to see where the devil lives, you look in your own heart. He couldn't have put him inside the mine itself."
I said, "Oh, no, there's tons and tons of rock sealing it off. Just making a path through it would be a major earth-moving project. Guy would need a backhoe or something."
"You didn't see anything unusual? I don't mean that night. I mean anything at all leading up to it, even if it was months ago. Mikey never said anything strange to you or had weird dreams?"
"No."
"Teachers at school never reported any odd behavior?"
"I homeschool. Don't need the government programming my boy to be a drone."
That fact seemed significant to John, judging by his face. Before I could ask why, Chastity said,
"But of course, there is the Bat Mantis."
Amy said, "The what?"
"The flying monster that's been stalking this place for the last few months? You, of all people, should have heard of that one."
John said, "I probably have an email buried in my inbox somewhere."
Chastity said, "You want to see it?"
I let out an exhausted sigh and said,
"Sure.
Why not?" It turned out Chastity was just offering to show us a video of the monster. She didn't have the creature tied up in her closet or anything. She took us into her bedroom and pulled out a laptop that was at least 4 years old, but didn't have so much as a fingerprint on it. She stored it in the original box when not in use, and it looked like she thoroughly cleaned it after each session. She navigated to a YouTube video with only 165 views. It got off to a very slow start. It was a guy using his phone to record an attempt to train his Pomeranian to catch a frisbee. After three attempts resulted in the plastic disc bouncing off the confused dog's face, suddenly someone in the background screamed, and the cameraman panned up to the sky. The creature that was flapping its wings up there was just low enough to make it abundantly clear that it was not a bird. From its silhouette, it appeared to be a pair of leathery bat wings connected by a body that looked something like a praying mantis that had been in a terrible accident. A moment after it was spotted, it swept back its wings and dive-bombed the cameraman, the moron continuing to film as the winged horror swooped down. There was a blur and a yelp, and now the creature was flying back up, the cameraman's little dog curled up in its hooked front legs. The title of the video, Bat Mantis? Chastity clicked back and paused the video near the middle so we could get the clearest look at the thing as it skimmed the ground to snatch its prey. It was pure white. The wings didn't match the body. One of its hooked front legs was much smaller than the other. The midsection was wider than the rest, as if it had a beer belly. It had a pair of big, dark eyes, but the shape of its brow gave it an expression like it was confused by the world it had been born into.
Ever see one of them before?
John said nothing. Amy looked pale. I said, It's, not in our database.
Hold on, there's more here.
She hit play, and the video cut away, picking up in another location, the scrapyard south of town. It was nighttime, a flashlight beam bouncing between the rows of rusting abandoned vehicles. The cameraman was no longer alone. He was flanked by two men with hunting rifles. In a harsh whisper, the cameraman said,
There! Up there!
The Bat Mantis was crouched atop a stack of six flattened cars. The top vehicle was an old convertible the monster was using as a nest. Muzzle flash and thunder filled the air, the men firing at the winged beast. It flinched and flew away, in seconds becoming a pale speck in the sky. The men approached the nest, and the cameraman climbed up the stacked cars to peer in, presumably holding out some faint hope that he'd find his dog alive in there. He shined his flashlight into the open interior. The beam illuminated a bowl-shaped structure like a huge bird's nest, filling the space where the front seats had once been. The nest was made of small bones, many still pink with blood and specks of remaining meat. Winding through the bones were colorful bits of rope and leather straps, speckled with shiny bits of metal here and there. Dog collars and leashes. Dozens of them. The cameraman screamed, and the video ended. The only YouTube comment was simply, fake. I heard rapid footsteps behind me and turned to see Amy was gone. From down the hallway in the direction of what was hopefully a bathroom, I could hear her retching. Chastity said,
I guess I should have warned you guys about the content. I didn't react too well the first time I watched it neither.
John said,
I know it's weird to say this, but for some reason it's worse when it's a dog.
Not weird to say at all. A person, they can be good or bad depending on the day. A good dog, well, it just wants to make you happy all the time.
Is the little girl talking? Did she get a look at what took her? John started to answer, but I quickly jumped in. She didn't see much, but she didn't describe getting swept up into the sky by a giant white mantis bat either. That seems like the kind of detail even a child wouldn't leave out. She said,
So am I to understand that this here monster's appearance and Mikey's disappearance were totally unrelated?
John said, In this town, very, very possible. He looked at me. We'll need to give it a name. It has a name. As far as Mikey, we're not ruling anything out. The fact that we found Maggie safe and sound should give us optimism, if nothing else. Amy returned, and she and Chastity started simultaneously apologizing over one another, the way women do. Chastity said,
You didn't tell me how much you charge.
Amy said,
Oh, we don't. Well, you do now. Either you're taking this job or you're not. I don't want some halfway bullshit where you act like you're doing me a favor and congratulating yourselves for making half an effort. This is work I need done. If you take it on, I want you to treat it like work.
I thought for a moment and said, Our fee is $275, payable if we find him. Amy and John both looked at me, wondering how in the hell I'd come up with that exact number. John said,
How much does Mikey weigh?
About 65 pounds.
He nodded.
Yeah, 275.
Amy said, Payable after we bring him back. We all stood, told Chastity we'd be in touch, and once more, we were driving through the rain. I asked Amy if she was feeling okay. She lied, yes. We drove in silence for a bit. Then out of the blue, Amy looked right at me and said, "We can fix all this. I know we can. We can beat Nymph and find this other kid and we'll be heroes. The cops will apologize and Ted will see he was wrong and everything will be okay." She nodded, as if agreeing with the words she just heard come out of her mouth. "Yes, everything will be okay." I said, "Amy, for all we know, there are already more kids missing as we speak. And just because you found Maggie in time, you know, this kind of situation doesn't usually play out like that. Usually, by the time they get to where the bad guy is holed up, they just find, well, a big pile of collars." Amy stared out of the rain-streaked passenger window in the back seat, and then burst into tears. I said, "What?" Chapter 10. A flashback to Amy's traumatic waffle experience. Amy. About 9 hours earlier, Sean had dropped Amy off at the Venus flytrap, and she had gone upstairs to have that momentary weird sensation that David had frozen in place. But then he started talking, and Amy didn't give it a second thought. That's because there was something far stranger going on. David, for the first time in months, seemed genuinely happy. She had asked, "Did you solve the thing with the little girl?" "We did," David had answered, whisking his waffle batter. "She's back home, safe and sound. Turned out there was nothing clown dick about it. It was just a local creep. We got the cops to track his phone and found his van. Whatever he was going to do, he never got a chance." They had taken a moment to revel in the victory, Amy, of course, ignorant of the fact that at that moment, John and the real David were still out trying to solve the case, and Maggie was still missing. Then Amy had noticed the roof leak was fixed and had been shocked to her core to hear that David had done it himself. "I'm making you waffles. You hungry?" She wasn't, but said, "Starving." He said, "Then have a seat. With what I've got planned, you'll need your energy." "Oh, really?" "You'll see." "How was work?" A question David hadn't asked her in probably a year. "Boring. Had an old lady who kept calling saying her dead husband was trying to break into her house, but it turned out it was her alive son. She had Alzheimer's, no monster stuff. So, how are you feeling?" "Great. I mean, we solved the case." "You had a rough night last night." He shrugged. "Nothing some waffles can't fix." She wandered over to the window. "Hey, where's the car?" "Oh, it's in the shop. Brakes started making noise." Of course, the car was not in the shop. The actual David was out driving it, heading toward the little church in search of John. But again, Amy had no way of knowing that. "Can we, afford that?" "Don't want to drive without brakes, Amy. What if the guy working the drive-through mistimes his throw? Have a seat." She sat. The card table had been cleared and dishes had been set. Real ones, not the paper plates David had started buying when he decided he didn't have enough energy to wash dishes anymore. "But that's what I want to talk about," David said. "John and I got paid for this one. Parents had a lot of money and they wouldn't take no for an answer. And the father, he said something to me that really hit home. He said that all he could think about while his daughter was missing was how if he had known his last day with her had been the last, everything would have been different. He'd have taken time to read her a story before bed. He'd have told her he loved her in a way that showed he meant it. He said if he got her back, he'd treat every day from now on like it could be the last, because it could. And I thought, that's exactly what I haven't been doing. So then I thought, what would I do if I knew it was my last day on Earth? The answer was easy. I'd go away with you somewhere, just the two of us. So I figured, why not just do it? You're going to decline Saturday overtime tomorrow. Today, you and I are going on a little getaway, a place with no TV, no internet. Okay. You're not going to get bored? Bored? The moment you walk in that door, I'm going to strip you naked, and by the time I'm done with you, you won't be able to move. If I ever get bored with that, maybe you should just put me out of my misery. Amy folded her arms on the table.
Oh, really? Only thing I ask. Sean doesn't bring you home anymore. You don't go anywhere with Sean anymore, not even in a group. Not that I blame him. He's acting how any man would act in proximity to one of the most beautiful women in the world. But if he threatens what we have, I'll lose control. You know I will. And I don't want to lose control, for my sake or his.
We can talk about that later.
No, we can't. Waffle iron's hot. Let's do this. And so they chatted and ate their waffles, and Amy couldn't stop smiling. She had suggested waiting for the rain to stop, or at least slack off a bit before heading out, but as soon as they'd eaten, David insisted they go. It's just water. Your clothes will get wet, but you won't be needing them the rest of the weekend anyway. She asked if they needed to call a cab, since the car was in the shop and all, but David said nothing, just walked out and headed down the stairs toward the store's parking lot. She followed, and found him unlocking a red sports car from the 1960s.
What's this?
This is a 1967 Chevy Impala, given to us by our grateful client. Title is in the glove box. It's ours, free and clear. Get in. She did. David twisted the key, and the engine rumbled to life. He turned to her and smiled. You hear that? Amy smiled back. I feel like we should both have varsity jackets on. And at least one of us should be smoking. Then we'll go join a Vietnam demonstration in favor of the war. They both laughed. David threw it in gear and they took off, rain lashing the Impala's cherry red hood, drops breaking and splattering against the layers of gleaming wax, a car that had been someone's baby. Amy said, "The storm is getting scary." David shrugged. A whole bunch of noise and not much else. Scary if you're in a plane or a small watercraft. If you're looking to go 2 miles in a kick-ass muscle car, not so much.
Where are we going again?
Part of our payment from the grateful family of the victim was one free weekend at their cabin at Mind's Eye. Got a screened-in deck overlooking the pond. We can listen to the rain, and the local wildlife can listen to me screwing your brains out.
Calm down there, cowboy.
Ha, sorry. This thing with the missing girl. When I saw her parents, the look on their faces when we brought her back safe and sound, I don't know. It's like all at once I realized that we do real good in the world. The detective on the case was there and he shook our hands and it's like, well, like we were legit, you know? Like we deserved to be there. That we had done what the cops couldn't.
Well, yeah, you should feel great about that. I've told you over and over.
I know, but you know how I get. That cloud that forms in my brain so that no sense can get through. Today, I just saw a break and a little bit of light came spilling in. And I can see the look on your face right now. You're trying not to get your hopes up because this is what I do. I get up for a while and then I crash. But that's the other thing. I called the doctor. I'm going to get a prescription. Try to regulate these moods. Appointment is next Tuesday.
Oh my God. David.
It's just time, you know? All this bullshit in my past, this fucked up childhood and those rough high school years. There's a point you've just got to let it go. Nobody is going to rewind and give me functioning parents. Nobody is going to flip a switch and make it so that I'm suddenly just like everybody else. I'm never going to fit in. But that's okay. All of this, it really can be okay. She reached over and held his hand. He looked over at her. Are you crying? She said, no, of course not. She laughed through her tears. How can you even see where you're driving? All I see is flying water. I can feel the wind pushing the car around. Are you sure you shouldn't pull over until this passes?
No need. We're here.
They sat in the car for a bit, waiting for at least a momentary break in the rain. The cabin standing in front of them was a modest but clean little place, perched over the mine pond. Then David put a hand on her thigh and leaned over and kissed her. She could feel him breathing, trembling, barely containing himself. It was getting close to green stripes territory, she thought. Amy had been known to read Cosmo from time to time, and in every single issue they'd do some variety of a "bring out the animal in your man" headline. David had once pointed out that every woman can remember the first time she got legitimately frightened by pushing the wrong button, or the right one, and actually saw that animal. Maybe it's heels in the bedroom, maybe it's a little bit of pain. Maybe it's dressing up in a schoolgirl outfit and doing baby talk. Every man, said David, has something, and sometimes even the man doesn't know what it is until he sees it. Amy had stumbled across David's animal button when she showed him the ooh-la-la costume she'd made for the game convention. There was nothing particularly scandalous about it, a flared white vinyl skirt, maybe a little too short, with a hoop sewn into it to give it a retro-futurism look. White boots, the dumb pink wig, the gloves. Part of the costume she had added without David's knowledge, though, was a modest pair of green and white striped underpants. This was another inside joke meant only for him. In the racier anime, Japanese animation if you're too old or cool to know that word, half the time the girls are wearing these green striped panties, some kind of culture-specific fetish, apparently. David thought anime was ridiculous, and Japanese fetishes even more so. She figured he would get a good laugh from them. David had been on his way out the door when she walked out of the bedroom to show him the finished outfit. He gave her a cursory compliment, and right before he would have closed the door, she had playfully lifted the skirt to show him the striped underwear. She laughed. David did not. He had gotten this look in his eye, then came back inside and closed the door behind him. What followed had been frantic. The underwear actually wound up with a little rip in them. She had found one of his animal buttons. That was the vibe she was getting from him now. David pulled back, looked out at the rain, and said impatiently, "We're going to be waiting all weekend. Let's just make a run for it." So they ran through the rain and bumbled their way inside the cabin, giggling like teenagers. There were animal heads on the walls, and the sound of the rain on the metal roof was deafening. Predictably, the moment they were inside, the winds died down, and it was just rain again. Across town, John was investigating the trunk of Nymph's car, their pursuit having ended with it getting sandwiched between the Jeep and a utility pole. Amy and David went through to the screened-in porch, the rain now falling straight down in a steady, peaceful rhythm. Across the pond, there was a little chapel perched up on a grassy hill. David kissed her and pawed at her, and she asked if they could slow down a bit. She said, "We have all weekend, right?" "I'll try to control myself, but I make no promises." He looked out toward the pond. "Do you like it?" Today, there was no hint of the shimmering teal water that could look at times like a setting from a fairy tale. Floodwater runoff had turned it into a swollen, muddy puddle, waves of fizzy drop splashes rolling across the surface. "It's beautiful." David sat down on a wicker sofa and patted the seat next to him. "I would say that I wished it was a nicer day, but I know better. This is Amy weather."
"Yeah. Well, when I have a roof over me, I'm sure I wouldn't like it if I was standing out in it all day. And, you know, if the whole town wasn't under a flood warning. But yeah, this amount of rain right here, fat drops falling straight down, just a cool breeze wafting in, makes me want to just curl up."
David put an arm around her. She leaned into him, felt his warmth. She said,
"I know this isn't your thing, the cabin, all that, aside from, you know, a private place to just have tons of sex, but this right here, just sitting here and melting into each other, us under a roof while the rain falls out there, this is heaven for me. These moments, like this.
Do you believe in heaven, Amy? Like a literal place?"
"I just meant it as a figure of speech."
"Still, serious question."
"I don't know. But if it's real, maybe you get to pick what it's like. Maybe everybody gets their own. Some burly biker dude, he gets to ride his Harley forever with his gang. Maybe the warriors go to Valhalla. But I just want this. Not the rain or the cabin, but just for all the distractions to go away, the money, the work, having to constantly stick food and pills into your body to keep it functioning? All that stuff that puts distance between us, all those boundaries, all those fears, it all goes away until it's just us, together, for as long as we want. Not even saying anything if we don't want to, just